we are currently working our way through the book of Genesis. And today we are continuing that process and will ultimately be in Genesis chapter 16 and the last part of that once we get that far this morning. All of us can recall times in our lives of great emotional or physical or combination thereof affliction and distress. On one occasion for myself, in a winter evening in the mid-2000s, I was walking home from my church office up in Pennsylvania, where I pastored for 28 years, and I'd walked this path hundreds of times. It was dark. I really wasn't paying any attention. I was probably daydreaming, thinking about the day's work and all sorts of other things, and I found the only patch of black ice in the parking lot and slipped on that patch of black ice and fell backwards and instinctively just reached my right hand down. But when it landed down, it didn't move. So all of my weight ended up here on my right shoulder. It hurt so bad, I actually laid there in the parking lot for at least a minute before I could get up, came into the house, had Linda help me take off the jacket because I couldn't move, felt like everything was broken in there, called the doctor. He said, well, there's nothing I can do now. So tomorrow, let's schedule an X-ray. Then we'll schedule an MRI. And the end result of all of that is I had torn my rotator cuff. Okay, so I needed surgery to repair that. So a week or so later, I'm in the outpatient clinic of the hospital, and I'm having surgery. Surgery went fine. By now, the pain had dissipated enough, so at least it was tolerable, and we had the surgery. And before the anesthesia wore off, the doctor said, here's the pain pills I want you to take. He said, I've got a 12-hour OxyContin. This will stay with you over a 12-hour period of time. Don't wait until the anesthesia is totally gone before you take this, because it'll take a while for it to start working. So just as you start to feel a little uncomfortable, take this. If the pain continues, I'm going to give you what he said, this is a quick hit pain reliever. Take this. You can take both of these together. You'll be fine. So I got home. Anesthesia started to wear off. I took the 12-hour pill. The pain got worse and worse. I took the quick hit pill. The pain got worse and worse. So here I am, literally on the floor of the den in my house in Pennsylvania, on my knees, tears streaming down my face, screaming for the pain to go away. I am in great distress. Linda calls the doctor. Here's his response. Just give it a while. I did, 30 seconds, and then we got in the car and went to the emergency room. And as soon as I got into the emergency room and the doctor there saw me and put me on a morphine drip, within literally a minute, pain's gone. I'm feeling really good at this particular point. So the doctor, the surgeon, happened to be on call that night. So he comes into the emergency room and here's his words. You weren't kidding, were you? Needless to say, the next time I needed surgery, I found a different surgeon, but that's a whole nother story. The physical affliction at that moment for me was so intense that it needed the proper medication to provide relief. In our passage this morning, as we look at Hagar, who is in great distress, not from rotator cuff surgery, but from having fled into the desert, no place to live, all alone, no food to eat, and on top of that, she's pregnant. If last week's lesson from the first six verses of Genesis 16 addressed how to respond to God when his promises appear to be delayed, this week's lesson addresses how God responds in times of affliction and distress and anguish. And what we'll discover, here's the big picture, here's the peek ahead, is that God does see and God does hear. And you'll see this repeated throughout this short text this morning. So turn in your Bibles, if you will, to Genesis chapter 16, and we're going to look in verses 7 through 16 of Genesis chapter 16. Verse 7, "The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, 'Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going?' And she said, 'I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai.' Then the angel of the Lord said to her, 'Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority.' Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, 'I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count.' The angel of the Lord said to her further, 'Behold, you are with child, and you'll bear a son, and you'll call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And he will live to the east of all his brothers.' Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, 'You are a God who sees.' For she said, 'Have I even remained alive here after seeing him?' Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahoiroi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Barad." So Hagar bore Abram a son. And Abram called the name of his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Now you remember last week that Sarai had concocted a plan, according to cultural custom, for her husband, Abram, to engage in an intimate relationship with her servant girl, Hagar, in the hopes that she, Hagar, would become pregnant and give birth to a son. Because Sarai was barren and well beyond the childbearing age, and she thought this would be a helpful plan in order to fulfill the promise that God had made to her husband, Abram, that he would have a son and he would have multiple descendants. Well, the plan worked perfectly. Abram went into Hagar. Hagar got pregnant. And Sarah rejoiced. No, that's not what the text says, does it? The plan worked. The relationships were shattered. So much so that Hagar flees. And this is where we pick up the story. Verse 7 begins what we're calling the second scene in this chapter. The first scene, verses 1 through 6, focused primarily on Sarai and her response to God's apparent delay in fulfilling his promise. The second scene focuses primarily on Hagar and her response to the affliction and distress that she's encountering. Sometimes when you read a text, you will notice things that are absent as well as things that are there. God is absent in the first six verses. Now, God is there in the sense that he's credited or blamed for the fact that Sarah is barren. But no one consulted God. No one sought God in reference to the plan that Sarah concocted. No one called to remembrance his promise or sought to discover what would be most pleasing to him. And God had yet spoken in the text. It would seem that since man had chosen to go his own way, i.e. Sarah and Abram have a plan, we're going to work all this out, God, we got this covered, God set aside and said, let's see how this is working for you. But now God speaks. Most translations begin verse 7 with the word now. And so it's focused on the timing. Sarai had made the plan. Hagar had become pregnant. Now there's distress between Sarah and Hagar. So Hagar flees. Now. But the specific word could be translated but. It could be and, now, or but. It's the same word that's used in a number of different other cases translated different ways. Most of the time it is translated now, but it could be translated but. And if you translate it but, here's how the connection between verse 6 and 7 would look. She, Hagar, fled from her, Sarai's face, but the angel of the Lord found her. Now, it's true in the timing aspect that now is the time that the angel of the Lord found her. But I like using the translation but, because it makes a deeper connection between where Hagar was and God's response to her. Hagar had fled, but the angel of the Lord found her. And found is an interesting word because it indicates action on the part of God, on the part of the angel of the Lord. There's no action on the part of Hagar outside of the fact that she's fled. Just as Adam and Eve were not seeking God when the Spirit of God found them in the garden after the fall, they were hiding. So Hagar was not seeking God either. She, in fact, was fleeing. Fleeing from Sarai, going somewhere. And he came to her at this place. And it's obvious that the angel did not stumble upon Hagar. The angel did not engage in a process of searching for her. Not like we do. You know, when we're looking for something, we say, it's going to take me forever to find this. I know I put it here. I can't believe it's not where I thought I put it. The angel of the Lord did not have that conversation internally within himself saying, what am I doing out here in the desert? This is a huge place. It's going to take me forever to find her out here. No, the angel of the Lord knew exactly where she was and exactly what time it was. And so the text tells us where she was. She was by a spring of water. She was in the wilderness. And the spring was on the way to a place called Shur, S-H-U-R. Shur, if you've got a map, and I probably should have put this in your outline notes, you can find it on the northwest area of the Sinai Desert, near the northeast border of Egypt. You can find this place called Shur. The way that the Hebrew text expresses it and uses the definite article, the, indicates that this is a well-known spot. It's on a well-known route. It appears that Hagar, because of where she had come from and where she was at this particular point, was making her way back to Egypt. After all, she was an Egyptian, right? She had been given by Pharaoh to Sarai and Abram as part of the dowry to get them to leave, and had been with them over this 10-year period of time. And now, because of the great distress between Sarai and Hagar, she's heading back. But think about the fact that she'd been gone for over 10 years, and she was a slave girl. And it was Pharaoh who had given her, told her she had to go with these two. What was she going back to? What kind of family did she have? Would anybody remember who she was? But from her perspective, she had no other place to go. So she's heading back to what she hopes would be a nicer place than where she was. Just as a total aside, there's a certain amount of irony in the geographical location of where Hagar is and where Sarai is at this moment. Because Sarai is back with Abram, and they're in a fertile area. Things are growing well. The famine's over. They're doing well. But Sarai is barren. Hagar is in a barren place, but she's pregnant. This passage is the first reference in the Old Testament to the angel of the Lord. That phrase occurs at least 48 times. I did not count them myself. I took the word of scholars to say that. So if you want to, you know, get out of concordance and look up the phrase angel of the Lord, go, oh, no, I only found 47. I'm okay with that. But at least 48 times. You can count them here in Genesis chapter 16 because there are four uses here in Genesis 16. There are two other times in the book of Genesis, and that's in Genesis chapter 22 in reference to Isaac. So it's interesting, the angel of the Lord in reference to Hagar and Ishmael, and the angel of the Lord in reference to Isaac. in Genesis chapter 22. Alan Ross, in his commentary, Creation and Blessing, in a short paragraph, states it this way. It's important in studying narrative literature to concentrate on the dialogue, especially the speeches from the Lord, for they usually underscore the point of the narrative. In this passage, the story itself, Hagar and her going back to Egypt, is not the message. The word from the Lord is the message, and the story is the setting for the message. So an important question for us to ask at this particular moment is, who is the angel of the Lord? This is the first occurrence in the Old Testament of this phrase, Malach Yahweh. Then who is the angel of the Lord? How is this angel of the Lord different from other angels, if he is different from other angels in the Old Testament and New Testament? I mean, because the phrase angel that's used simply means messenger. That's what it means. That the Old Testament means that in the New Testament. So can we determine anything about the character and the nature and the identity of the angel of the Lord in terms of both the message and the messenger himself? I.e., is it just an angel, or is this angel a pre-incarnate Christ? Well, let's look at a totally different passage to kind of help us along that line. So keep your fingers here in Genesis 16 and look over in Exodus chapter 3. Again, a well-known text. You know this. We're not going to spend a lot of time here. This is Moses at the burning bush. But I want you to notice the phrasing of what happens in Exodus chapter 3 in the first six verses. Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord, same phrase, appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. He looked. Behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he, God, said, Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he also said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. So you know this. I mean, Moses comes to the mountain. The angel of the Lord appears to him in a burning bush. Moses turns aside to see who it is. Just a second. And the text says, when the Lord, Yahweh, saw that Moses turned aside, God called to him from the midst of the bush. And the angel, the messenger, the Lord, declares the ground to be holy. And then the messenger identifies himself as God. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So there's no doubt that in this case, here in Exodus chapter 3, the angel of the Lord is the pre-incarnate Christ, appearing as a burning bush. Mike.
Can a garden variety angel kill 185,000 soldiers in a night?
I would say yes.
Okay. I mean, I know
they're pretty powerful.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know, but my inclination would be that they can accomplish a great deal beyond what you and I could accomplish. And so, again, trying to determine, context has a whole lot to determine whether that's the pre-incarnate Christ or whether it's a messenger, an angel himself. Yes, John.
So, because Michael's fighting literally Satan in the Old Testament, you're fighting Satan, you have to believe you could kill humans.
There's a lot about angels we don't know, and so we could spend all of our time conjecturing on what we don't know, or we can look at text and say this is what we do know. And this text here in Exodus 3 reminds us that there are times when the angel of the Lord is God himself. It is the pre-incarnate Christ. Going back to Genesis 16, Chip. Well, that's God appears, you know, and speaks. It's not called an angel. It's called the Lord.
Right.
So but you know
if
then.
The angel is the Lord.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a similarity in what's happening here.
Oh, there is a similarity.
There's a similarity.
Sure. Absolutely. Joe.
So the other question is then, so what difference would it make if it's the incarnate Christ, and what difference would it make if it's an angel?
One difference might be the extent of the ability of the angel, i.e. is most of the time when you see an angel that isn't the pre-incarnate Christ, the angel is simply delivering a message from God himself. He's the conduit of the message. When the angel of the Lord appears, he's both the message and the messenger. Okay, so he's both. And you'll see this in the text in Genesis. So hold on to that thought so that you can kind of see the development of this in the text. Because if you go back to Genesis chapter 16, and you look in verse 10 of Genesis chapter 16, and so we're skipping ahead a little bit. The angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants. And so this kind of goes back to Mike's questions. Can an angel kill? Well, can an angel create life? And my comment to that would be no. So the only individual, only being that is going to multiply descendants is God. And so this angel of the Lord said, I will. This is God's commitment to make this happen. Then in chapter, in verse 13, she called the name of the Lord, Yahweh. It's that in the text, it's the use of the covenant-keeping God who spoke to her, you are the God who sees. Hagar recognized that this was not just an angel, but this was God, because then her second statement, can I even remain alive because I've seen God? You know, is that even possible in her perspective? So in light of that, it appears that Hagar has encountered the pre-incarnate Christ. She's on her way back to Egypt. She wasn't looking for God, from what we can tell in the text. She's trying to escape from everything that she had experienced with Sarai and Abram. But God encounters Hagar. By the way, so that you kind of get the whole broad brushstroke picture, the encounters with the angel of the Lord are only found in the Old Testament. There are no encounters with the angel of the Lord in the New Testament. Why is that? Because if the angel of the Lord is the pre-incarnate Christ, what happens in the New Testament? Christ has already taken on human flesh. He has showed up so that John can say, you know, the Word became flesh and dwelt, literally tabernacled, I love that phrase, amongst us. He spent time with us. And what we beheld, says John, is the only begotten glory of God himself, the glory of the Son. The encounter with God and Hagar by the spring here in the wilderness may remind you, by the way, if that truly is the pre-incarnate Christ, of another encounter that Jesus himself had with a woman at a well. You remember the Samaritan woman? And the text in John says he had to go through Samaria. Well, geographically, there were other ways to get there, but not to encounter this woman. He was going to find her. He knew where she was and what was going to happen. So we have another foreigner, Hagar, an Egyptian, the woman at the well in the New Testament, a Samaritan. Both are intentionally found by God, and their situations are by a well. I think I could make a message out of that if I wanted to. But again, I don't want to get lost in the weeds and conjecture. Back to the text. Note that the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ, begins a conversation with two questions. Do you find Jesus often asking questions when he encounters an audience? He was a master at that. Notice what the angel says to Hagar. Where are you coming from? And where are you going? Now, you know that when God asks a question, it's not because he doesn't know the answer. It always reminds you of the statement that lawyers make. You know, never ask a question you don't know the answer to. Well, God knows the answer to all the questions. The question he's asking is not for his benefit. It's kind of like when he came to Adam in the garden. Where are you? I've been looking for you. Where are you? Or to Cain, where's your brother? The question is intended to cause Hagar to think about her situation, to think about where she was, where she had come from, and where are you going? Well, Hagar had a ready answer to the question, didn't she? She said, this is where I'm going from. I'm running away from my mistress, the one who is my master. I'm fleeing from her. The angel then has a statement. Having asked the question, having received an answer, verse 9, the angel of the Lord said. Now, before we look specifically at what she said, I want you to notice what she didn't say. Okay? She didn't say, I know. He didn't say, excuse me, the angel of the Lord didn't say, I know that serving Sarai has been tough. I know she's been hard on you. Sarai should have treated you better. I know you would have responded better if she treated you better. And I know it wasn't your idea to go into Abram and become pregnant. Things are hard, but they're going to get better. She didn't say any of that, did she? Or he didn't say any of that. What did the angel of the Lord say? Verse 9. Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. He commanded her to return to the one who had authority over her. You have to go back. This is what you need to do. And I couldn't help but think of a New Testament text found in 1 Peter chapter 2, and I think I included this in your notes, where Peter says, servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. For this finds favor, for the sake of conscience towards God, a man bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if when you sin you're harshly treated, you endure it with patience, but if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it? This finds favor with God. The reality of the fact that is in our day and age, in our culture, and it's probably been true in cultures throughout generations, it's easier to talk about pleasure and fulfillment than it is about duty. You know, just I just want to be happy. Don't we all? But we don't talk about duty. But that's what God told Hagar to do. Tend to your duty, even if it's drudgery or downright unpleasant. And sometimes as believers, that's what we need. You just need to do what you're supposed to do. So just deal with it. Yeah, it's called obedience. Exactly. God, as the angel of the Lord, does not seek to change Hagar's status in life. Matter of fact, he sends her back to her status. She remains Sarai's maid, and she remains in submission to Sarai's authority. But God also intends to bless her. And you get to verse 10. And moreover, the angel of the Lord said, I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count. Now, obviously, this may remind you of another text, right? Earlier in Genesis, God said almost the exact same thing to Abram. It's not the same promise. The similarity is that Hagar will be the ancestress to a great nation. But her descendants will not produce the promised son. The Messiah will come through Abram and Sarah. In one sense, it's a blessing that exists to Hagar simply because of her relationship with Abram. One writer called it a flow-through blessing of the Abrahamic covenant. God made the covenant with Abram. Hagar has a relationship with Abram. She's going to be blessed as well. Jeff?
Well, there are two gates. Right?
Yeah.
And there are two pathways. One's broad, many are those who find it. One's narrow, a few of those.
Yeah. One of the interesting questions, by the way, that just reminds me of the question that one can ask, was Hagar a true believer in Yahweh? The text doesn't say, does it? I tend to think the answer to that yes, because of what happens and how she responds. But I cannot categorically say that from a biblical perspective. But the first blessing, yes, ma'am.
I would submit that because she did not answer the intercept question, because she did not know where she was going.
Oh, well, that's true.
And I think part of it is because since she's been with Abraham and Sarah for 10 years, she's seen how they worship the Lord and she's come to know the Lord.
Yeah, because we have forgotten who God is and the promises that he's made. And we think we know better.
Well, as far as recognizing the angel of the Lord as Yahweh, okay, anybody who comes in his presence is going to bow and or fall on their face and say, woe unto me. They know that. That's unavoidable.
Yeah.
They're sinners.
And so the first blessing is she's going to have descendants. The second blessing is that one of those descendants is going to be a son. And it's the description of the son that's fascinating in this text. He has a colorful name and a colorful character, if you will. His name will be Ishmael. Ishmael means God hears. The angel tells Hagar to name her son God Hears. Why? Because God had taken note of Hagar's plight and heard her cry, even though the text doesn't say she cried out. You have to imagine that she did cry out to the Lord. His name then is going to be a testimony throughout generations that God cares for his own. God hears. He also is categorized as a wild donkey. A wild donkey. Fascinating little phrase here about, my notes are out of order. Hold on just a second while I get to the right page of where I want to be. You know, it's always fascinating when things get out of order. And you think they're in order. Hold on, I'll get there. Okay, I'm good, I think. Before I get to wild donkey. If Hagar had truly become a believer while she was with Hagar, or while she was Hagar with Sarai and Abram, that may give credence to the questions that the angel of the Lord asked her. Where are you from and where are you going? Why are you leaving a house of faith and returning to a land of idols is another way to translate that if he's really looking at her current situation. As a pastor, I've had numerous conversations, or at least a number of conversations, with people who used to be connected to a local church, but because they had their feelings hurt, or they were offended in some way, or they weren't appreciated the way they thought for something that they had done, they're not going anywhere anymore. And in the course of the conversation, as I just engaged with them to get to know them a little bit better, I've discovered that from a spiritual perspective at that moment, they're not really doing very well. They haven't forgiven the one who hurt them. They're holding on to a grudge. They're stuck in the past. Their prayer life is sluggish at best. Which leads me to rephrase the question that the angel asked Hagar, to what makes one think that there's better blessing outside the church than in the church? Spoiler alert, by the way, in case you're new to the church. If you've never been offended or had your feelings hurt by someone in the church, then you haven't engaged with people in the church. Now, I'm not condoning bad behavior, okay? I'm not condoning rudeness among believers. But what I'm saying is there are no perfect churches. Or as Howard Hendricks used to remind us, when you find the perfect church, don't join, you'll ruin it. You cannot control other people's behavior, but we are commanded to control our own. Paul states it this way in Colossians chapter 3, verse 12 to 14. So as those who have been chosen of God, this is who you are, chosen of God, holy and beloved. So you're already holy, you're already loved, you're already chosen. This is who you are. God has done all this. Therefore, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. This is your responsibility, okay? My responsibility. Bearing with one another. You know, that means putting up with the idiosyncrasies of the people around you, other believers. Forgiving each other. Whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you. This is where the rubber really meets the road, because how has God forgiven us? Freely, completely, graciously, unmeritedly. So also should you, and beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. And in essence, the angel of the Lord is saying to Hagar, return to Sarai and act like who you are. One who knows me. As for Ishmael, his character, as I stated earlier, is described as a wild donkey. The idea behind that phrase contains the sense of dividing by creating schisms between people. It indicates a lifestyle that's outside of the accepted social conventions. Ishmael is going to be a man who's a troublemaker. And one of his traits will be that of an aggressor, a wild donkey. His independence is described further in verse 12. His hand is going to be against everyone and everybody's going to be against him. The main thing that's going to characterize his life is conflict. It intensifies the picture here of the antagonist Ishmael and the hostilities that will occur. Now, you know, the Arabs trace their ancestry to Abraham through Ishmael. The Jews trace their ancestry to Abraham through Isaac. So is there any doubt as to why there's conflict between the Jewish nation and the Arab world? But in fairness, if I can say this, just as much blame for all of this goes back to Sarai and Abram. One, because they engaged in the scheme. Two, because they'd already been to Egypt. That's where they got Hagar in the first place. You know, one bad decision can have long-term consequences. And that's what Abram and Sarai are going to experience. By the way, does it strike you as surprising that Hagar is the first woman who is given the promise of a son. Prior to this, Sarai is not given the promise except through Abraham. God has not spoken to Sarai. Now, he will, but in the chronology of the Old Testament, Hagar is the first woman to receive a birth annunciation and the first woman to receive promises from the Lord. Think about that for a minute. By remaining submissive to Abram's household and Sarah's wishes, she and her son are going to enjoy the benefits of the patriarchal blessing. And notice how Hagar responds to all of this. Verse 13. Hagar gives a descriptive name. She called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God who sees. You're the God who sees me." Remember that the story is the context to the message. Hagar, having heard from the Lord and received the message, responds to the message by saying, "God sees me." And the word to see means to consider, to give attention to have regard for someone. It's not a glance. Oh, yeah, I saw that. It's not even observation of giving it a little more thought. It has the idea of responding to and acting on someone's behalf. God sees me. God has acted on my behalf in the midst of my distress. God has taken note of Hagar. God has taken note of her trouble. He'd heard her prayer. He saw her need. So God cares for his people. And because God gives her the son and calls him a name, God says his name shall be Ishmael. God hears. We know that God sees and God hears. See, because embedded in the story are insight into God's character, who he is and what he does. And as we stated earlier, when we forget or fail to recognize who God is, we, like Hagar and Sarai and Abram, are prone to make poor decisions and develop lousy attitudes because we've forgotten who God is. God sees. God hears. She asks a rhetorical question. Mike.
Do you think that had an influence on Melville and naming the narrator in the whale?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'd have to think about that a little bit more.
Yeah.
Probably, but I think good writers, you know, take those things into consideration. Sure. And so she asked one of those rhetorical questions, you know, have I remained alive here after seeing him? God is the one who's seen me. God has heard. And God has appeared as the angel of the Lord. Am I going to stay alive? Knowing that, again, you cannot see God and live. And I wonder if it wasn't similar to Moses' situation on Mount Sinai when he wanted to see the glory of the Lord and God revealed his backside, almost as if Hagar had her face down, head down. Can I really live? Or the angel of the Lord was veiled in a certain way and it was the voice that she heard. I don't know. But she was concerned about her own well-being at that particular point. But she honors who God is with what we'll call, what I'll call a third name. If the first name is Ishmael, God hears. And the second name is God sees. The third is the name of the well, Baal Lahai Roy, which means the well of the living one who sees me. Again, Alan Ross in his commentary says, in the story, the motif of hearing becomes important. The child was about to be called Ishmael because the Lord heard Hagar's affliction, her harsh treatment from Sarai. The hearing motif reappears in chapter 17 and verse 20 when God heard Abram. and chapter 21 and verse 17, where God heard Ishmael. Here God hears Hagar. Abram and Sarai had ignored the proper source for fulfillment of the promise. Ishmael's name would forever be a reminder. God hears. Ross goes on to say, interestingly, Isaac did not make the same mistake when his wife was barren. He prayed. Genesis chapter 25 and verse 21. Hagar is obedient to the words of the Lord. She goes back. She returns. What was that reunion like? How do you think Sarai responded to Hagar's return? What did they say? Man, have I got a lot of unanswered questions. But that's not unusual. What we do know, again, is Hagar gave birth to Ishmael. But note who gave him the name. Abram. So Hagar must have told Abram what had occurred in her encounter with the angel of the Lord. And Abram responds by following through on naming the son Ishmael. Again, I just think it's a reminder throughout his early life, every time Sarai or Abram heard his name, they heard the word, God hears. They needed to be reminded, God hears, I hear you, call out to me. The culmination of the story provides the lesson literally for the whole unit. It records God's direct revelation and Hagar's faith response. God sees distress. He sees the affliction. He hears the cry for help. And Hagar's obedient. Yeah.
Do you see an identity between hearing and obedience, not just obedience, but obedience to the law of God, to the ontological nature of God? That's called love.
Okay.
Right? And the difference between Hagar's response, because while God is the creator of all people, he is not the father of all children. He's not the father whose children are, the father is the devil. Who is a liar?
John chapter 8, yeah.
There's a difference there. Do you see any kind of resemblance in this? The Hagar went back. All right, but that's not the hearing of obedience of the law of God. It is, she went back in response to that, but it wasn't a true submission to Yahweh.
Interesting thought. I don't know, Chip. I think you could probably make a case for both, or either or, that it was a true submission because she did go back. She did live in a difficult situation. She gave birth to the son. As far as we know, we don't know if the relationship was ever rectified, whether she forgave Sarah. None of that is recorded for us. So again, like I said, we got a lot of unanswered questions. But I think the whole context is reminding us by virtue of the names that are given that God hears and God sees us in our distress. Abram and Sarai should have known that. God knew that Sarai was barren. And she knew that God knew because she said it's God's fault. She should have cried out to the Lord like Hannah did in 1 Samuel chapter 1. Instead, Sarai had to learn the hard way. From the experience of a despised slave girl who came back with the faith experience and a word from God, Ishmael, God hears. Yes.
Yes. So
Yes, we can surmise that there was a sense of submission and a change of heart and a willingness to be obedient and to do the right thing. Yeah.
It wasn't just enough to physically go back. She had to change her attitude as well.
Yeah.
But isn't this true of Cain and Abel? I mean, Abel heard the Lord.
Yeah, but he went his own way, right?
No. He provided the right sacrifice and he was killed.
Oh, okay. You're talking prior to killing Abel.
Right.
You're talking about bringing...
Yeah.
Yes.
How is it that Abel knew the difference? He had to have a revelation from God as to what that sacrifice would be. So Cain got the same revelation, but he didn't respond to it.
Yes.
Except by murder.
Yeah. If I get rid of the person who's different than me, then that's better.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know... And again, following through on this whole Hagar-Sarai thing, when she went back, the situation was still tense, as far as we know. But the Lord sent her with a message and with hope. The message is God hears and God sees, and the hope is you're going to have a son. And he's going to have multiple descendants. And I think we've implied as well that therefore that requires faith on the part of Hagar. Because the major tensions in the story have yet to be resolved when she's there. Sarai is still barren. The promise is still to come. The relationship between Sarai and Hagar needs some work. The message, I think, in the text is really timeless because it's into great distress. Here it's barrenness and affliction. But in whatever our distress is, I think the text is reminding us that we ought to be people who pray. We are to people who cry out to the Lord because he sees and he hears. But his response may not come in our time. So that requires faith and trust in his character. If he truly hears and he truly sees, then he'll always do what's right. And I have to trust that. Joe, you were going to say something?
Yeah, and towards the end of verse 13, where she says, "Truly here I have seen him who looks after me."
Yeah.
That just his seeing and his hearing isn't as personal as what she made it there.
Yes, yeah.
And that going back into that situation, knowing that there's a personal view of what she's going through, makes all the difference.
Oh, makes all the difference. That's right. And the application, again, for us is making that person, God sees and God hears, is not just a theological statement. You know, in the midst of my distress, God sees and God hears. And I have to trust him to put my faith and confidence in him. So that the writer to the Hebrews can say, and I'll conclude with this, "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession, know what is true, and hold on to that. God sees, God hears. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who is tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, draw near with confidence. Come boldly to the throne of grace. Cry out, seek the Lord. Because there you receive mercy, and you find grace to help in time of need." Please note in the text, I love this text because it doesn't say you get the answers you want to the cry out you have. What you receive is mercy and grace to help, to get through the time, to bring us through the transition. Because that's who God is. God sees, God hears, he responds to, acts on our behalf. It's very personal. You have a personal relationship with the Creator God. Is that incredible or what? And therefore, you can come boldly to the throne of grace. You can cry out with whatever distress, affliction you're experiencing, and God sees and God hears. And he can be trusted to do what's right. Let's pray together. Father, thank you. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for reminding us in the midst of a person who it's easy to overlook, even maybe ridicule at times. Reminding us that you hear and you see and you care for those who are your own. Remind us of that, Father, in the midst of our distresses, because it's easy to forget. And so, Lord, thank you again for loving us. In Jesus' name, amen.